Last week, Pope Francis went to Canada. I don't think people here paid much attention to it, but it was quite a striking trip for the Pope to take. And a lot of people now trying to evaluate the meaning of it all are struck by the fact that he spent so much time and went to such effort to reach out to the indigenous people of Canada and make an apology to them. Only a few weeks before, he had canceled a long-planned trip to Africa, which is much closer, and it was a shorter trip. Instead, he, at his age and in his physical condition, went all the way to Canada, and not only to Canada, but all around Canada. He probably traveled more within Canada than he would have traveled if he had gone to Africa. Canada is a huge country, as you know. And he spent days there. So people are starting to say, well, he spent more time with the indigenous people than he spends with heads of state who come, who, you know, people when, say, the president goes to visit, he spends a half hour with him or something like that. Or his own cardinals and bishops, he spends a little time with them. But with the indigenous people, he spent days. Well, I bring this up because this is clearly a message that the Pope is trying to give to the Church. It goes along with his emphasis from the very beginning that the gospel cannot be contained among the people who are already evangelized. It has to be brought to the edges. It has to be brought to the peripheries, the people farthest away. So he put into practice what he tells the Church to do. Go to the peripheries. Go to people who are on the margins of society and on the margins of the Church, and be present to them too. Now, no one can do that to everyone, especially not the Pope. He can't go to every marginal place and every marginal people. He's using these indigenous peoples of Canada as an example. Now, I say that as a kind of preface to our reflection on today's gospel, where we see Jesus going to the region of Tyre and Sidon. Tyre and Sidon were pagan cities. They were not in the Holy Land. They were north of Galilee, up in what was Phoenicia. I think it's Lebanon now. I'm not quite sure, Lebanon or Syria. It's in that, no, it's Lebanon. It's right on the coast of the Eastern Mediterranean. And to the Jews, those were places you wouldn't bother going to because God is not there. God is in his land, in the Holy Land. God watches over his people, and those people have other gods. We don't know what the apostles thought about going to Tyre and Sidon, but they probably wondered, what are we doing here? Why are we here? Now, since the last couple of days, we've heard about Jesus making attempts to withdraw for prayer, to take time aside. Perhaps that was part of what he was doing here, although it's quite a long way to walk up to Phoenicia from Galilee. But perhaps he was doing that, or perhaps he was taking the apostles out of their usual routine and exposing them to the wider world. Probably had many reasons for doing this. I think we should not interpret it wrongly and say that he was going away from his mission. Something like Jonah. Remember the prophet Jonah when he was sent to Nineveh in the east. Instead, he tried to go as far west as he could go. Well, Jesus, who hears about the death of John the Baptist in Jerusalem and knows that he has to go to Jerusalem to lay down his life, here he goes, Jerusalem is south, instead he goes to the far north. They say this is as far north as we know Jesus ever went, region of Tyre and Sidon. Also, Caesarea Philippi is up in that direction. Anyway, he's not going away from his mission, he's fulfilling his mission. He's revealing that his mission, which is first to the Jews, first to the people of Israel, is not limited to the people of Israel. But the way he does it is quite puzzling. He goes there seemingly expecting not to be recognized, but here a Canaanite woman, a pagan woman from that place, approaches him to beg for help for her daughter. She's an outsider. She's on the peripheries. She's someone that the established Jewish leaders would not have paid any attention to. And Jesus doesn't pay any attention to her. At least that's how he acts. He doesn't even say anything. Along come the disciples and they say, "We'll just send her away. I mean, what does she have to do with us?" Remember, Jesus, when he sent out the apostles, he said, "Don't go to pagan territories. Go first to the children of Israel." So they probably thought he would not or should not attend to her. But she perseveres. She approaches him again. "Lord, help me. Lord, help me." It reminded me of what Peter said in yesterday's gospel. "Lord, save me." I would like to look in the original language and see if it's the same. Anyway, it's a prayer, something like Peter sinking into the water. "Lord, save me. Lord, help me." In the case of Peter yesterday, Jesus immediately answered and reached out and grabbed him. In the case of this woman, he, what looks to us, insults her. "It is not right to take the food of the children and throw it to the dogs." We have to remember how language changes over time. I thought of this in the case of the Pope going to the Indigenous peoples of Canada. That's the official language they use now, is Indigenous peoples. They don't call them Indians now, or natives, because that's considered demeaning or rude. So but generations past, they would be called Indians, and it wouldn't have been considered an insult. And now, when we hear Jesus talk about this woman as a dog, we immediately say, that's a very insulting thing to say. It doesn't mean that he intended it as an insult. So that's part of the difficulty of using language in different eras. I don't know if it's as big a problem here in the Philippines as it is in the States, but language keeps changing, and marginalized people or minorities are seemingly changing the terms by which they can be referred, and it's hard to keep up to make sure you use the right terms. And if you use the wrong term, the former language, well, it's really inappropriate. It's really insulting. Whether you intend it as an insult or not, it's easy to step on people's toes these days. Well, I'm just saying that on the side. It's hard for us to interpret what that expression, throwing the food to the dogs, would have meant to the Jews. That's what they said. That's what they call the pagans. Dogs, pigs. I mean, that's what they call them. I don't think that they were being completely insulting. That was their recognition that God had not chosen those people. They were outsiders. So, and Jesus uses the language of his time. But even with all those cautions, it sure seems like an insult. The great thing here, and it seems as if Jesus deliberately sets himself up to be overcome by the faith of the woman. He says, "You're a dog and we don't throw food to the dogs." She says, "Yes, I'm a dog, and dogs get the food." Dogs get the food that falls from the table of the masters, and that's good enough for me. I'm not insulted. I'll accept that. I'll accept a scrap, because even a scrap is enough to save my daughter. It's an extraordinary reaction. A humble and yet courageous. Humble and yet bold and with strong faith. Extraordinary reaction, and it impresses the Lord. "Woman, great is your faith." If you can say that, you pass the test. If you can persevere, even at the moment when it seems God himself is insulting you, well, then you pass the test. Part of what is striking about this is in yesterday's gospel, Jesus said to Peter, "O you of little faith." And he says to this woman, "Great is your faith." So we see yesterday and today a contrast between little faith and great faith. Ironically, little faith is Peter, the rock, the apostle, the one chosen on whom Jesus will build the church, the one who you would think would have the greatest faith of all, one of the apostles. And here, a pagan woman who we would expect to have no faith at all has great faith. You see how God shakes us up? He doesn't let us settle into categories or perceptions that we think are obviously true. You see why I think that's part of why Pope Francis does things that surprise people. He realizes God shakes us up out of our kind of standard way of thinking. God does that. Great is your faith. Great is your faith. Now, we are not exactly in the situation of this Canaanite woman, but we are being taught something about faith. If we want to have great faith, we have to be able to persevere even when we feel insulted by God Himself. We might not put it that way, but how often have we prayed and not gotten any answer, just like this woman? How often have we prayed and had somebody tell us, "Why don't you just give up?" Like this woman. How often have we prayed and had God give us an answer that seemed to be insulting? Just like this woman. Well, do we persevere just like this woman? That's the lesson. Great faith does not force God to do anything. Great faith opens us to the greatness that God has in mind for us, which is far beyond what we have in mind. So great faith is the opening of a door. Remember what Jesus said about the mustard seed of faith. If you had faith the size of a mustard seed, you could do great things. Imagine if you had a little bit of faith, you could do great things. But if you have great faith, there's no end. There's no limit to what God can do. I think that's part of what we're being taught here. So, yes, we're to open our eyes and hearts to the action of God in surprising ways, on the margins of our awareness and our culture and even of the church. God is everywhere. He works where He works. And we have to be ready for God to work. And the only way to be ready is to have great faith. So let us open our hearts like this unlikely Canaanite woman. Let us open our hearts with great faith.